Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things that they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like? This is the Overton window at work. This concept, coined by the Mackinac Center's Joe Overton, describes the range of ideas that are politically acceptable at any time. Politicians are bound by this window and can only act within a narrow set of ideas. And on the Overton Window podcast, we talk to people who work to shift the Overton window and change what is politically possible. Joining us today is Dave Hebert, who is a senior research fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me today.
Tell us a little bit about your background in the policy world.
Yeah, absolutely. So my background is a bit longer than I would have liked at this point, but it's been kind of fun. So I did my undergraduate at Hillsdale College. I majored in economics, then went off to George Mason University to do a master's and a PhD. While I was there, I was a Mercatus Fellow in the Mercatus Center. I was also working for the Senate. I'm sorry, not the Senate at that time. I was with the House Joint Economic Committee, working for Kevin Brady, who was a Republican from the great state of Texas. And there, you know, I spent 3 months or so just working on, you know, the Affordable Care Act and a few other, you know, no-name bills that we've all not heard of ever. After completing my PhD, I became an economics professor. So I started off at Ferris State University, went down to Troy University in Alabama, and then came back up to Michigan to join Aquinas College. During that time, I found some opportunity to go work for the Senate Budget Committee in the U.S. Senate, where I worked on budget process reform. So there, the chairman of the committee was Mike Enzi, who was the senior senator from Wyoming. And he was really passionate, at least at the time, in reforming the budget process and trying to get the country's budget, you know, under control. And so, you know, Bill Beach was the chief economist at the time. He later became the commissioner of the BLS, but at the time he was the chief economist for the committee. And he and I set about working on a comprehensive report. And so, you know, we did that together. And most recently, just about a year and a half ago now, I left higher ed and joined the American Institute for Economic Research as a senior research fellow. My areas include tariffs, national debt, and international trade. And I still remember when my boss, Sam Gregg, when he was interviewing me, he told me, you know, look, Dave, we're looking to hire someone to write about tariffs and national debt. And I distinctly recall thinking, I don't know if I told him at the time, you know, how could you hire someone for those two topics? Everyone already agrees that tariffs are bad, and everyone agrees that we should do something about national debt. And so it was just a prescient moment where, you know, Sam either knew something that I didn't know, which is almost certainly true, or he just kind of got lucky, and so did I. So ever since about May of 2024, I've just been writing popular pieces about, you know, tariffs, national debt, international trade, trade balances, all kinds of, you know, to me, really fun stuff. So it's been a joy.
Yeah. And I think what is somewhat unique in your background is the variety of different policy approaches you've been involved in. So thinking about the Overton window, thinking about changing policy, you've worked on congressional committees and in academia and now at a think tank. So I want to know from you, like, how do you think about your role in policy change and shifting the Overton window? And, you know, how has it changed in your in the different roles that you've had?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think what we've seen, especially in the last, you know, 12 years or so, is the role of the economist kind of changing in the policy sphere. So, you know, 12 years ago when I was starting out, you know, the economist would come into the room and like a chill would, you know, descend on the room. And all of a sudden it was not that we were, you know, truth sayers or anything like that, but, you know, suddenly it became, you know, oh man, there's like a serious contender for, you know, argumentation, for evidence, for logic, you know, that's entered the scene. And we kind of got some deference at some level, you know, and if you saw economists disagreeing, you know, everyone seemed to understand that, you know, yes, we were disagreeing about, you know, the outcomes, but there was never really a impeachment of, you know, the person's ideology or, you know, impugning of their integrity. It was always about, you know, different assumptions that went into the conclusions. And at the end of the day, different normative judgments about which of the trade-offs, you know, were best. Today, we kind of see the opposite. So an economist walks into the room and everyone gets on their, you know, heels, or not on their heels, on their toes rather, ready to like shout down and tell us that this is a dismal pseudoscience, that everything that, you know, we've known and held, you know, near and dear to our hearts as truth is lies, and that we've kind of conned the American people. So the change has been, you know, massive, at least from what I can tell. What's curious about it to me is the evidence that we use and that we bring to bear has never been more available and more accessible, right? So in, you know, ye olden days of 2015, right, you would have to use all kinds of really fancy, you know, software that was really expensive to access a lot of the information. And people would just have to, you know, take us at our word that this was the information. Well, today, anyone with a computer or even just a cell phone can get that data for free very quickly. One of my colleagues pointed out that the St. Louis Federal Reserve actually has an iPhone app for their FRED database, which means on your phone, you can pull up any piece of economic, you know, information you want anywhere in the world at any time. And it's just incredible. So we no longer have to be, you know, blindly at some level trusted that what we're showing people is what the data says. They can just go look at the data. And so the fact that our trust is waning is just a really fascinating kind of sociological thing that's going on today.
Yeah. And how does that impact the work that you do at AIER and maybe the broader work of think tanks more generally?
Yeah, also a great question. So the way I kind of look at it is, you know, in a think tank world, you kind of have two options for what kind of work you're going to do. You're either going to try to be, you know, very timely and be the person that gets the story out, you know, first, right? Or you're going to kind of speak, you know, timeless truths. And then, you know, whatever's going on in the day or the week is kind of going to be your example, right? And so in normal times, you can do, you know, both pretty easily, right? It's not too difficult to be the first when something new comes out and it stays consistent for more than a few days. I think what we've seen in 2025 is that consistency has been eroded, right? So look at, you know, especially the first quarter of the year from, you know, January through April 1st, right? Tariff policy, one of the things that I work a lot on, changed almost every 3 days. Right. So if you wanted to be the first person to get something out there, I mean, you had to be, you know, Johnny on the spot, paying attention to all the news outlets all the time, and then ready to sit down at a computer and just write. So, you know, I remember writing about, you know, tariff policy and something that happened. And I was up until like 1 o'clock in the morning trying to get this article done and sent in, you know, to even just our own in-house publication, The Daily Economy. Right. And there, you know, because I work at the Institute, I can, you know, just send it straight to the editor and get it in fairly quickly. But by the time we woke up at, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning or whatever, that news story had already shifted and my article was completely irrelevant. And so all that time was spent writing and working on something that never got to see the light of day. And so that's really frustrating when you're trying to be, you know, timely. So what I'm trying to work on right now is really trying to focus on that second one. Right. Really try to speak those timeless truths that we know, you know, are true, that have held for hundreds of years at this point, and that have been evidenced throughout history. And so focusing there is really kind of the nuts and bolts of at least what I try to do and what we try to do at, you know, AIER, while also trying to remain current. And that's, you know, the tension between those two is omnipresent. But I think so far, at least, we've done a pretty good job at navigating that tension.
Yeah, it sounds like it would be difficult to compete, right? In the because you're competing for attention, and there's a lot of people who want to, who can and who desire to, you know, consume people's attention. So it's a very busy market and competitive one. But you, of course, have the advantage of having principled economic theories that you can draw from that never get old, that never go stale. So those are also important. How does all of this differ from the kind of work that you did in academia when you were teaching and doing more academic type of research?
Yeah. So, being a teacher and working at a university or college setting, I mean, to me, it's just the greatest job, right? And it's also the most terrifying job on the planet. Someone like some mom and dad and some at some level, I'm going to call them a kid. I know they're 18, but, I'm 38 years old and I know I'm young for, everything I'm doing. But to me, they still look like kids. So I'm just going to call them kids. There's a parent that has entrusted you with the responsibility and the obligation to educate their child such that they can go out and compete in an incredibly global, competition workspace. And so I still remember, come August every year, I would be thrilled to get back into the classroom, but also just terrified of just that sheer weight of that responsibility. Right. And so, that's a real issue and a real thing that matters, right? When it comes to, working and teaching in the classroom, I was very fortunate. I went to Hillsdale. I had fantastic economics professors there. I went to George Mason. I had fantastic economics professors there as well. And one of them, Walter Williams, really just impressed upon us that the classroom is never to be used to proselytize or indoctrinate, ever. Right. So you can teach them the good stuff. You can say things like, hey, when the price of apples goes up, people are going to buy fewer apples. You can teach them the effects of minimum wage laws, right? And that they're going to cause, higher unemployment or at the very least disemployment effects. But that does not give you the right to therefore test them or teach them that minimum wages are bad. You have to keep it in the realm of the positive analysis and keep away from the normative stuff. And we see the left, failing to do this all the time. But it's equally pernicious on the right. And I was just so happy to work with or to get to learn from, Walter Williams and see how he kind of lived and demonstrated that example in his classroom. When it comes to academic writing, the difference between what I did as a college professor and what I'm doing now is night and day. Right. In academic writing, you can spend, 3, 6, 12 months writing, a paper. And you're going to have to cite, 100 different articles to show that you've read everything and that you're making, what you claim to be a novel or original contribution to the literature. And then you're going to have to send it out to referees. And those referees will usually take, 2, 3, 4 months to get their assessment back to the editor. And then the editor's got to make a decision. Point is, from the time you start the project to the time the project potentially sees the light of day, could easily be 12, 18, even 24 months. And by the time you get through that entire gamut, at least for me, right, I didn't feel joy. I didn't feel excitement. I just felt relief. Right? I was just like, oh, thank God this project is over and I don't have to think about this ever again. Right. And so that was really kind of the impetus behind why I wanted to leave higher ed. I found myself my last 2 years really kind of not necessarily avoiding, students and my colleagues, but not seeking them out as much as I had in the past. And then the academic writing, I just came to dread it. Well, if you dread, interacting with students, you don't want to interact with colleagues and you don't want to do academic writing, why would you be a professor? Right. And so that really kind of led me to say, I've got to find something new. Right. And fortunately, AIER was hiring at the time. I knew a bunch of people there already. One of my colleagues, Paul Mueller, I've known him for 20 years, right? We had our very first class at Hillsdale College together 20 years ago this week, actually. And so it's been just an absolute joy to find that opportunity and shift into sort of the faster moving, more popular pieces.
Yeah, we at the Mackinac Center, we always say that slower process, academic research is vital still, even though, it has its own issues and it is slow moving. The audience is small, right? Like only a small group of economists read that material. It's not meant for a general audience, but it's very important still because it provides kind of the foundation for what all the other kinds of writing that we can do and all the lessons that we can learn in the more open, popular, general kind of communication and education that we do and that AEIR does as well. I know you've written a lot about tariffs and the Jones Act. Thinking about the Overton window here, those, you know, from an economic perspective, right, it's very clear what should be done with those policies, right? Like, there should be minimal to no tariffs, and the Jones Act is just needless. But that is not something that any elected official that I know of endorses right now. So yeah. how do you think about that when you write about these issues that, you know, all at best you can kind of nudge people in a certain direction and towards the better policy, but it really is the policy preference is outside of the window.
Yeah, you know, you raise a great point, and I think you really hit the nail on the head by using the word nudge there, right? So obviously, total victory is well outside of the Overton window at this particular point. But what we can do right now, and what I've been trying to do as much as I can, right, is two things. One is lay the groundwork for when the Overton window actually does shift. So having, you know, projects on the shelf, having things already out there that evidence that, you know, these things are bad ideas, that they're counter to their very stated goals, right? Having all of that out there and ready to go, ready to be picked up when the window inevitably does shift is really, you know, just vital. The second thing that I focus on, especially with respect to the Jones Act at this particular juncture, is not necessarily saying, you know, hey, we should just scrap this entire thing. That's well afield of the Overton window, and it has been for over 100 years at this point. So that window is pretty firm. I like to think it's moving in the direction that I want it to move, not just because of me. There's excellent work coming out of, for example, the Cato Institute as well on the Jones Act. But that one's moving a lot more slowly than I would have liked. And so what we can do is point out examples where exceptions have been granted. So in the case of the Jones Act, it's almost always rescinded temporarily in cases of national emergencies, or I'm sorry, natural disasters. And so when those things happen, we tend to see, you know, the president or, you know, various people in D.C., basically say, hey, we're going to just temporarily, you know, suspend the Jones Act. Any ship can come into any port, no matter where they came from and what they're carrying. We need to get people back on their feet. And then we see other exceptions for, you know, some of our remote islands like American Samoa or the Bahamas or certain other, you know, localities within the United States that are at some level isolated. Well, okay, once we have exceptions for a few of these places, why not have exceptions for more of them? Right. At this point, you know, some of the exceptions that don't exist. So, for example, like Hawaii is not exempt from the Jones Act. Because of this, what we see are cows being flown by airplane from Hawaii to California and then shipped by truck. You can get a lot of cows on an airplane, but not that many. And it's also really expensive. Right. But if I could put cows on a ship instead, I can suddenly cut the cost of beef dramatically for the American people, and I can increase the ability of farmers in Hawaii to ship their beef around the world. And so if I can make these, you know, little tiny tweaks and just say, hey, listen, you know, let's let Hawaii have an exemption here, right? If I can point out the tremendous economic gains from not necessarily repealing the whole act, but just granting a new exception to it, that can be entirely feasible. And that's one of those things that I think we can do within the Overton window that we're operating in, you know, right now. As that window shifts, you know, yeah, we can start talking about paring it back even more. But it's important to both lay the groundwork for what we want to do in the future while also being cognizant of what we can accomplish today.
Yeah, yeah. That's good way to approach it. Do you view what you do as attempting to shift the Overton window too? I mean, you talked about, you know, kind of when it shifts as, you know, a little bit, maybe it's a dynamic that no one can really control. And that's probably true. But there's also, I think, a certain amount of work that think tanks do that is aimed at trying to shift the window, trying to influence people to understand policies that politicians aren't talking about right now, but that aren't politically acceptable right now, but that should be, or that they should aspire to in the future.
Yeah, so we're always trying to shift that window, but it happens in, you know, fits and spurts. It's never going to be the case that I can just kind of like grab it and drag it all the way over to where I want it to be, right? But I can kind of nudge and push the frame at least a little bit and expand the window or contract it in directions that I don't want it to go in, right? And so a lot of what I try to do is just provide, you know, as much evidence of, you know, in the case of tariffs, of what's actually happening, right? And there, the real strategy that I've been, you know, taught and have learned since joining AIER is not just about, you know, your argument, but where are you actually placing the argument? So how do you get that argument in front of new people who would be open and receptive to, you know, what you're trying to say? And how can you frame that message in such a way that people are going to be, you know, looking at it and saying, huh, you know, maybe there's something to this. So for that reason, you know, I've written a lot about tariffs, but the two that stand out in my mind are the two articles I had in the Detroit News just this year, you know, both of them targeting the Michigan economy. Now, you know, you're in Midland, I'm in Grand Rapids, you know, I'm from Michigan, you're from Michigan. So this is a state that obviously we care a lot about, but this is also a state that has had promises made, you know, in very particular cases from the president and the administration. And if you just look at the evidence and you look at what's going on in local communities, you see kind of the exact opposite being delivered. And so pointing that out and just saying, you know, hey, Michigan, right, here's an argument. Here's a thing that can help you think about, you know, what's going on in the world around you. You know, you're not crazy. Factories actually are closing in Michigan. That's true. And it's because of these tariffs raising the cost of, you know, production in this country, right? It's not a state trend. It's not a national trend that just happens to be happening at the state level, as, you know, Matt Hall, the Speaker of the House, said back in July, right? This is actually a thing that is happening in Michigan. It's not just a national trend. It's a thing that's happening specifically to us. And so pointing those out and getting that message in front of Michiganders, right? That's the secret sauce, if you will. Getting the message out and to the right people, you know, at the same time.
Yeah. So, who in your current role, who are the right people? Who are you trying to influence in the kind of writing and other presentations or those kinds of things that you do? Who's the target audience?
So for me, the target audience is always going to be the American people and the voters, right? At the end of the day, I'm still an educator at heart, right? Mm-hmm. And I like to think that what I do is still just education. It's just with a different, you know, class and a different, you know, classroom setting, if you will, yeah. Right? So at the end of the day, I still see what I'm doing right now as very similar to higher ed, you know, education. The difference is I don't have to grade. Right. I don't have to hold office hours and I don't have to go to department meetings. So it's really kind of like the best of all possible worlds. Right. I get to do all the things that I love doing. Right. Without any of the things I didn't like doing. And so it's perfect. Right. So I'm always trying to target, you know, the American people and just show them, you know, what's going on. Because at the end of the day, you know, the federal government and the state government is all constituted, you know, by the consent of the people. Right. They derive their power from that consent, at least a legitimate government does. And so if we can change what the people are thinking, or at least show them a different way to think through the issues, you know, using the lens of economics in my case, right? If I can show them that new way and show them how to evaluate evidence in a clear and consistent manner, then, you know, those people will start demanding different things out of their policymakers. And all of a sudden the Overton window starts to shift. So to me, it's all about, you know, getting that message to the voters. Now, we do speak to policymakers. So in a few weeks, actually, I'm heading to Washington, D.C., where we're going to talk to a bunch of, you know, senators and representatives about policy issues, you know, unique to their states. But even there, it's about showing, you know, what's going on in their state, how federal policy is affecting their state, and what they could do differently that would benefit their state and the other 49 states as well. So it is, you know, a two-pronged approach, but mm-hmm. most of what I think I do and most of what I think we all should be doing is really trying to focus on the voters, get them the information that they need and make sure that they understand the trade-offs that are, you know, being faced by these policy choices that policymakers make every day.
Yeah. And it's an important reminder too that when we think about the Overton window, where it exists, where it shifts, how it moves is not determined by politicians. It is the voter sentiment. It's this amorphous kind of sense that voters have about what policies are acceptable, and it's difficult to control, but you can impossible probably, but you can nudge people in certain directions and get them to maybe embrace ideas that they hadn't before, and that's what can help shift it. Last question, last bit of discussion here. I read Brian Kaplan's Myth of the Rational Voter a long time ago. And, you know, he talks about four biases that are sort of ingrained in voters. And they seem like they make your job really difficult. So I wanted to get your reaction to them. The four that he identified are anti-market bias, anti-foreigner bias, make work bias, and pessimism. Yeah, bias based on pessimism of the economy and things. Does that make your, is he right about that? Are there these biases kind of ingrained in voters' ideas about the economy, and how can those be overcome? How do you approach that?
Yeah, so I think those biases are incredibly well-founded, and Brian did an amazing job at evidencing them in that book. I mean, it's a phenomenal book, and if anyone listening here, you know, hasn't read it, I can't recommend picking up a copy and just reading it, you know, right away. It's just truly a huge achievement.
Anytime you find a readable book from an economist, you've got to read it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great, I mean, it's super readable. You know, he walks you through everything. He shows you all the data, yeah. Right, in a clear and convincing way. So it's just a great book. And I'm so happy that, you know, he's at George Mason and I got to learn from him as well as Walter and everyone else there. So, you know, Brian's book and the biases that he points out, you know, do make things a little bit more difficult. But at the same time, being aware of those biases, the way Brian has made us aware of them, really kind of points us in a direction that says, you know, hey, these are things you're going to have to contend with. And it's much easier to confront something that you know is out there than things you don't know, right? You remember Donald Rumsfeld, you know, known knowns and unknown unknowns and everything. So these are known knowns. Like, we know that these things are out there and we're going to have to confront them. And everything that I think I try to do, and I'm not going to say this is the best thing for everyone, but it seems to be working out given, you know, my personality, is just trying to relate all of those, you know, issues to individual people and say, you know, hey, you noticed that, like, there might have been someone who immigrated here working at your grocery store and you thought nothing of it. Why do we think about that differently at sort of a national level than we do on an individual level? Or, you know, hey, isn't that computer you just bought like a great computer? And everyone's like, yeah, it's fantastic. And it was at a great price too, wasn't it? Yeah, great price, right? That came from, you know, China or Taiwan or wherever else it came from, right? That seems pretty cool, right? They're like, yeah, it does. Now, at the same time, the pessimism bias to me is the hardest one to kind of counter. Because you can point to, you know, statistics like low unemployment rates. You can point to anemic job growth in the last 3 months. You can point to the fact that, you know, U.S. manufacturing is at very close to its all-time high. You can point out that, you know, investment has not dried up in this country. That, in fact, there's more investment today than there's ever been, right? And it's continuing to grow. You can point to all those things and show people the evidence. But at the end of the day, that pessimism, or, you know, what the kids are probably calling, you know, the vibe check economy, really kind of dominates, right? And with good reason. College students today face an incredibly tough labor market. There's really kind of no disputing that. And they're having a hard time, you know, buying cars that are getting increasingly more expensive, not just because of tariffs, but because of things like CAFE standards, making it so that cars become more and more and more expensive. They're finding a harder time buying a house, right? Why is that? Well, building starter homes is actually more expensive per square foot than building a big mega mansion. So what do we see? More big mansions, fewer starter homes. But that just means that first rung on the home ownership ladder is getting cut out. And so that's going to make their life even harder. Then you get in, you know, to the landlord situation where more and more landlords are buying up more and more property for, you know, retail or real estate investment opportunities, right? And now all of a sudden, you know, the starter homes that exist, well, you're buying against someone, you're competing to buy it against someone who's 50 years old and has cash, right? And you're, you know, 25 years old and have to get a mortgage with a ridiculously high, you know, interest rate, right? And all kinds of other contingencies. So it becomes a really difficult thing for people under the age of, let's say, 30. And that's real. So you've got to be cognizant of both the data and how people are feeling and really just try to speak to them about how can we do better? Because clearly we can.
Yeah, I really like that of trying to connect the importance of these policy issues back to them individually. That seems like the most successful or likely approach to get someone to understand the importance of some of these issues. Yeah, well, that's all the time we have for this episode of the Overton Window Podcast. Thanks, Dave, for joining us today. And we hope to see you next time.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Mike.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.